This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
The world's number one superpower is completely falling apart. We're seeing looting, burning, beating, policemen being shot, major mainstream voices in the media and politics, celebrities, major U.S. companies saying it's all understandable and even just. We're seeing policemen being told to let all of this happen. We're seeing angry mobs demanding that policemen and soldiers take a knee. We're seeing the rise of a virulently lawless spirit in America, more extreme than anything we've seen before, and the collapse of law and order. Mr. Stephen Fleury showed several images and videos of these types of things on this morning's Trumpet Daily Radio show. I would really encourage you to watch that episode and the Trumpet Dailies from this week. This morning he was talking about just how much Satan is inspiring so much of what we're seeing at this time in America. He referenced Gerald Fleury's Key of David program that is airing this weekend, Satan's Frightening Power. I would really encourage you to make sure that you watch that program this weekend. For the first half of the show today, we're going to look at several aspects of this story. We're going to start with a bit of free-flowing discussion about this. We're going to start with Andrew giving us a look at how this is a planned insurrection. It's being fueled by communist groups. Andrew.
Yeah, there have been, by latest count, about 430 cities across the nation that have protests and riots. So we haven't seen anything like this in decades, maybe ever. We've had race riots, but this is like over 400 different cities across the nation. And a lot of it is being planned by radically leftist, radical socialist, radical communist groups. At Epoch Times, Trevor Luden, he's one of the best researchers, in my opinion, on communism's influence in the world today, has an article titled, "Cities Burn, But None Dare Call It Communist Insurrection." And he goes through group after group. He points to the Democratic Socialists of America. They're not necessarily overtly communist, or at least they don't own up to it, but one of the most influential, and that the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a member. They're big supporters of Senator Bernie Sanders. But they've even got Facebook pages where they're helping organize protests by getting making list of like plywood that people can get for shields, or tennis rackets or hockey sticks that people can get for weapons. So you don't come to a protest with a plywood shield and a hockey stick if you're planning on peacefully demonstrating.
Yeah.
It also goes through the Revolutionary Communist Party USA. They're probably the most radical one. They're actually agitating for a Stalinist dictatorship that encompasses Canada and the United States. Now, unlike the Democratic Socialist Party of America, they don't have a lot of members, maybe only several hundred members. But they're in past protests, they've been very influential at making a lot of the signs. If you always look at like placards and signs at protests, race protests especially, you'll oftentimes see the revcom.com web address in the lower corner where people show up for a protest and there's just some communist handing out signs to everyone.
So this is an interesting question, and maybe I'll just pitch this open to everybody. We've been hearing from the media almost incessantly that these are mostly peaceful protests. And these groups that you're talking about, you have essentially folks that are deliberately trying to turn peaceful protests into violent protests. And there are people who are very well organized, and they're doing this in a deliberate fashion. And at the same time, I think it's easy to look at the videos and to see what looks like, you know, mass violence, mass demonstration, and looting and burning and that type of thing. How much is what we are seeing kind of a small group of people who are making this happen versus widespread, what the other message is coming from companies and so many in the media is that the discontent, the anger that people have over racist violence and police oppression in America is vast. There's this huge well of anger. So which is it? How much is it the individuals who are stirring this up versus, you know, real widespread grievance?
I think it's definitely a little bit from column A, a little bit from column B. I think in the case of the Democratic Socialist of America, they have actually planned a few protests. Revolutionary Communist Party, I don't know of any protests they've ever planned, but they oftentimes come to protests that are happening and burn a flag or throw a rock at a police officer or hand out pamphlets about rebellion, or you're trying to make it worse. So I think there's one former KGB defector, he died some years ago, but he came to America, Yuri Bezmenov, talking about communist subversion techniques. And he likened it that he says a lot of communist, at least in the Soviet Union, studied judo, like Vladimir Putin studied judo. But the reason for that, as he said, it's the subversion's very like judo. It's like you're looking at a smaller opponent, usually going up against a bigger guy. You can't necessarily just grab him and throw him into a wall via brute strength. So you like dodge out of the way, look at the momentum of where he's already going, and shove him in the back and exacerbate what he's done to himself, mm-hmm. Making the point that like a lot of these race problems in America, they're problems that exist in America without help from the communist. But because of these, I guess, like sins of the people, these outside groups can get in there and inflame the tensions and make it worse.
It does feel like the media wants it both ways. They want to say that it's mostly peaceful protest, and they want to say that it's widespread anger that is manifesting itself in understandable and even just violence.
Yeah, I think what kind of stands out to me the most, looking at this from outside America, is the massive role that the media are playing here. I think if you knew nothing about America, you never visited there, or if you had just for a week on holiday and everything that you knew about what was happening was coming from the mainstream media, I think you would believe two things. I think one, you would believe that life as a black person in America, you were always in serious danger from the police.
Right.
You know, based on the coverage that we're hearing over from the mainstream media, I think you would think if as a black person, if you walk down the streets of America, there was a pretty good chance a police officer would come up to you and shoot you or attack you for no reason. I mean, that's the kind of impression that's being painted by the mainstream media. So I think that is one takeaway you'd have. And then the other is that these protests have massive widespread support, that you would get the impression that of the 325 million people in America, most of them are right on board with this. Most of them, if they're not out there in person, they are cheering them on at home. I think that's definitely the impression you get from, say, Twitter and a lot of the way social media puts this across, a lot of the way it's covered. You know, any... If you're watching from Europe, say, especially, you're not going on PJ Media or the Federalist or National Republic. You know, you're looking on CNN, MSNBC, the New York Times. And the message you're getting from that is that everybody hates Mr. Trump. Everybody is against the police. Everybody is in support of the protesters. And the reality on both of those is so completely different. And so demonstrably different. For both of those, it's kind of a complete fact-free zone. When you mm-hmm. never hear the mainstream media discussing the actual statistics, if anybody brings up numbers, you know that they're against this whole Black Lives Matter and this protest movement. Right. Because the numbers just aren't there. What, you know, what was it? I think the protests have killed more unarmed black people in the last week than the American police did in the last year. There is no rational case for that. And then even in terms of how many people showing up to protest, you don't see crowd sizes. You know, we've covered lots of protests at the Trumpet. I remember there were endless discussions of were there a million people in Tahrir Square in Cairo in Egypt when the Muslim Brotherhood fell? What percentage of Hong Kong's population was showing up on the protests? And was it really 5% of Hong Kong that was coming? You don't see any numbers on the number of people that are it's shots that show a full shot full of people. That's easy to crop. That's easy to set up. You rarely even see aerial pictures. And so I think you have this massively false impression that a lot of people outside of America and a lot of people within America are getting from the mainstream media. And you look at what Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry was writing even 20, 30 years ago, talking about, well, the deadly, dangerous mainstream media, about how this is one of the biggest threats that there is to America. And I think at the time you might have been able to look at that and think, well, okay, the media is a bit biased, but deadly, dangerous? I mean, surely that's a bit of an exaggeration. And here we are. And I don't think it's an exaggeration at all to say the media is putting the survival of the nation at risk. The media is stoking civil war. And I think that's something that even potentially most Americans may well agree with right now. So there's a massive role, I think, in the media and distort. We live in it's an alternative reality that they're putting out to a lot of people.
Well, you see the same thing with so many of these mainstream companies jumping on board with this. And you see the role of social media and email marketing. And these companies actually feel like we must express our contempt and our disdain for what has happened here if we're going to be able to survive as a company. You know, during the COVID crisis, it seemed like we kind of entered this new realm where every company wanted to make the case that we care about you and we want to retain you as our customer and that type of thing. And now, just a few weeks later, this is unprecedented. And I've just never seen this kind of this urge to show solidarity with this group of Americans that is destroying the country, that they're expressing deep sadness over George Floyd, which is nobody disagrees that that was a tragedy. Nobody is taking the side of a policeman who did something atrocious to that man by any measure. But they're expressing themselves in ways where they're demonstrating solidarity with the worst of what is happening out there. This has never happened before, and I think it just contributes to what you're saying about the sense that there's a consensus that something needs to change, that this has been so unjust for so long and we need to fix it now.
And I think the media's had a role in that too. I mean, these companies, they don't want to come under attack by Twitter mobs and mainstream media, and they know that agreeing is the only way out. But then on some level, I think even that doesn't explain it, just how the level of irrationality. You know, these are, as Andrew's been talking about, hard left communist protests. I mean, you look at like Antifa's program, and it basically is a communist manifesto. And you've got these pictures where you see, you probably see them on social media. You have a press release from Ben & Jerry's supporting the protesters and a smashed up and burnt out Ben & Jerry's store that the protesters have attacked. You know, if these guys get their way, these big companies are toast.
Yeah.
They don't, the CEOs are losing all their money and getting lined up against the wall and shot. So why on earth are they supporting them? Without understanding that spiritual reality behind what's going on here, I think at some level it just becomes hard to understand.
Yeah, I just think one other really disturbing aspect of this is just the movement that it's driving to defund police forces across America. The movement to defund police has unprecedented support right now, and it's gaining more and more all the time. But what people don't seem to understand is that police forces are the thin blue line that keeps society really from descending into violence and chaos. So if you defund and demoralize and weaken police, if you erase that thin blue line, you're eroding the rule of law. And if you don't have the rule of law, you have basically the law of the jungle, you know, anarchy, which is just the antithesis of freedom And I just wonder, does anyone think far enough ahead to understand what they're actually pushing toward?
Well, that trend has been going on for quite some time, and you just have to wonder. I mean, I've wondered for quite a long time, what does it take for a person to actually say, I want to be a police officer? And these police who are put in a situation where no matter what they do, they're going to be criticized. Those who stand down and allow that to happen, there are a lot of people who are really angry about what's happening in these cities and in these towns. Anytime a police officer actually stands up and tries to stop some of that violence from taking place, someone's there with his cell phone and someone's going to take a picture and someone's going to take a video and post it and spread it, and that police officer could very well face the loss of his job or worse. And a lot of these policemen are actually being attacked. Some of them are being shot.
Yeah, I do think that's really interesting that, you know, we did see back in 2015 with the Ferguson riots, we did see a call at that point from the mass media to not necessarily defund the police, but definitely blame the police for the institutional racism that caused the death of the hands up, don't shoot man. But I think what's different now is you have a tandem of causes here that are converging on the part of the media. The media was pushing that narrative as well, and yet you had Barack Obama as the president of the United States. And so what the police were doing and what the government were doing was seen as and two opposite spectrums in a way. President Obama is going to do what he can to try and contain the police. And now you have that gone. You have a mass media that also wants to get rid of President Trump at the same time. And so there's absolutely nothing to restrain the media from going into onto this narrative that the police now are an extension of whatever they do. It's an extension of President Trump.
Right.
And so that's why you saw, you know, a lot of people come out and talk against, you know, President Trump coming out and sending in the National Guard. The media was talking about how can you possibly do this. Even Esper, the defense secretary, talked about some of the actions with using the military, and that shouldn't be done. And even Mattis talked about how that shouldn't be done as well. And yet, if you look at the latest polls on that, about 48% of Democrats, registered Democrat voters, actually support that. They support the president getting involved.
That's
militarily.
One of those numbers that you're not going to hear publicized
right.
in the media.
Most people in their homes, whether they're Democrat or Republican, is about half of the Democrats and well over half of the Republicans that want President Trump to go in there and defend their cities when they see the police being told to stand down by mostly Democrat governors and mostly Democrat mayors. Even in Minneapolis, you had, I think this Mr. Stephen Flurry mentioned this already, this was in the third ward, one of their representatives tweeting, several of us on the council are working to find out what it would take to disband the Minneapolis Police Department and start fresh with a community-oriented, nonviolent public safety and outreach capacity. Yeah. You've got to be talking about some of these regions where most of the crime is happening, most in these black neighborhoods that are actually being torched. You go into the houses for those that aren't protesting, some with the parents, some of the grandparents, and you can bet that they want to keep the police on the streets and that they want most likely to send in to get help from the president if they can.
You say, yeah, it's just crazy. It's just crazy watching all this go down. You're looking back through American history for anything similar, and the closest you can come is like the 1968, 1969 civil rights riots. And even then, those were riots over some civil rights violations at a level that you're not seeing today. But the founder of our parent magazine, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, was on the scene during those riots in 1968, 1969. And he had what's turned out to be a really prophetic statement in the March 1969 Plain Truth, where he said, "Why are our people unable to recognize the communist line, the communist plan and conspiracy in colleges, in university riots, in propaganda, accusing police brutality, in Black Power, Black Panther, and other slogans, even in civil disobedience and nonviolent movements of protest, which lead to violence? The guiding hand in student revolt is the Communist Party. Many students, their emotions stirred and enraged to violence, don't even realize this. Yet actually, these young leaders of the New Left movement are going beyond the Communist Party. Their plan is to stir up college-age students to revolt first and teenage high school adolescents. If they can corrupt and win over tomorrow's students, they will gain control. And, of course, at the time he's written that, there was, like, actual influence by the Communist Party of Russia to try to stir up these students. But then he's even... it's almost even like prophesying there that, like, so this ball that you've gotten rolling, even without necessarily guidance from Russia, it's like said, if you can re-educate the next generation, they'll go even beyond what the KGB intended.
Yeah. Well, just one other thought, just to kind of return to the point about just how mainstream this has become, and. I think Stephen Fleury was bringing this out this morning as well. You have all of these people who were so strongly advocating stay at home during the COVID-19 crisis. And suddenly these same people are doing an about face and saying, no, we actually need to get out and protest now that this new issue has hit the scene. Some of the very same politicians who were so serious about enforcing the stay-at-home policies are now encouraging people to go out and protest. Stephen Fleury was talking about this epidemiologist from Johns Hopkins who tweeted earlier in the week, we should always evaluate the risks and benefits of efforts to control the virus. In this moment, the public health risks of not protesting to demand an end to systemic racism greatly exceed the harms of the virus. The public health risks of not protesting exceed the harms of the virus. So there was actually an NPR tweet that said dozens of public health and disease experts have signed an open letter in support of the nationwide anti-racism protests. They wrote, white supremacy is a lethal public health issue that predates and contributes to COVID-19. So the same people who said it's worth destroying America's economy in order to protect us from this disease, now they're saying it's worth the risks involved in protests that are destroying America's cities that is more important than protecting ourselves from this virus. So it's a complete 180. And the only consistency in between those two opposite positions is the fact that it's about destroying America. I do want to move on a little bit. I wrote a trumpet brief that went out yesterday talking about the way that enemy nations of America are responding to what's happening within the United States. These nations that have been wanting to see America go down, they seem to really be savoring all of these images of American cities burning, and they're eager to pour salt on America's wounds. I want to just give each of our foreign correspondents here an opportunity to just talk about what's happening within your region on this front, and we'll start with the message coming out of China from Jeremiah.
Yes, well, China is high on the list of countries that would like to see America go down, as you just said there. And this week we've seen Chinese authorities just unleash a whole volley of criticism about the way some law enforcers in the U.S. Are treating protesters and rioters. Probably the most notable example of this came from China's state-run Global Times. So this is, it's basically just a mouthpiece for the Chinese Communist Party. And they posted a video of some New York City police driving into a barricade, which sent some protesters on the other side of the barricade sprawling. And next to that post, the Global Times wrote, quote, peacekeepers or mass murderers. So, you know, this incident in New York City, it was upsetting, and it didn't end up injuring any protesters, but it could have, and an investigation into it has been opened. But what's really amazing about this is the fact that the People's Republic of China is castigating another nation's treatment of protesters during the anniversary week of the Tiananmen Square massacre. That, to me, is just, it's surreal. the level of hypocrisy that's on display here. So that massacre was 31 years ago today. It was one of the most barbaric instances in recent memory of a government slaughtering its own people. It started with Chinese students and other citizens who wanted to have a voice in how they were governed. They were tired of the Chinese Communist Party's corruption. So they gathered in Tiananmen Square there in central Beijing to call for the government to make reforms. And the government let these protests go on for a while, and these were peaceful protests. But after several weeks, the Chinese leaders started to fear that a real revolution could happen. So they declared martial law in Beijing, and they mobilized the People's Liberation Army. And on June 3rd, the troops were ordered to advance to Tiananmen Square and to clear the location by the next morning. And I'd like to just read a little bit from a diplomatic cable written by Sir Alan Donald. He was Britain's ambassador to China at the time. And he wrote, quote, "At one point, students were told that they were given 1 hour to leave the square. But after 5 minutes, armored personnel carriers attacked. Students linked arms but were mown down. Armored personnel carriers then ran over the bodies time and time again, and remains were collected by bulldozer. Remains were incinerated and then hosed down drains." And then he talks about injured female students who begged for their lives, but they were still bayoneted to death. He wrote about a young mother who was shot dead as she was trying to assist her wounded 3-year-old daughter. The details in Sir Alan's report are just beyond gruesome. And then he concludes, "Minimum estimate of civilian dead, 10,000. So, you know, that's how China dealt with peaceful protesters 31 years ago this week. And of course, none of this excuses any excessive force on the part of American law enforcement today as they try to minimize damage from what are often violent protests. But I just think that it is, it's just staggering for the CCP of all governments to sermonize to another country about human rights abuses and about mass murderers. Because this week is the anniversary of that cruel barbarism, which truly was mass murder.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, the pinnacle of hypocrisy. And as much as China wants everyone to forget that the 6-4 Tiananmen Square massacre happened, I think we need to do all we can to make sure that we never forget that tragic history.
Yeah, they prevented Hong Kong residents from memorializing that date today as well, at the same time that they're criticizing the United States. Now we'll look at some other nations, including Iran. We'll turn it over to Brent.
Yeah, it was just amazing to see the Twitter feeds of the foreign minister, Javad Zarif, and also the Ayatollah, the supreme leader of Iran, and also the spokesman for the Iranian government, as well as the President Rouhani. Everyone, it seemed, had their perspective to offer about how the American government was destroying its own people through racism. This is just one quote. This is from the supreme leader of Iran. "If you have colored skin, are black, or are Amerindian Indian, and are walking the streets of the United States, you cannot be sure that you'll be alive in a few minutes." That's from the supreme leader in Iran. This is from this foreign ministry spokesman. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman to the American people, "The world has heard your outcry over the state oppression. The world is standing with you. The American regime is perusing violence and bullying at home and abroad. Stop violence against your people and let them breathe." It's just really interesting to hear something like that, because it would have been, I don't know, 3 months ago when there was protests inside Iran, you would have seen American leaders say a similar thing about the Iranian people, calling out to them and saying, "We hear you. You've got to stop the madness, what the regime is doing." And the reverse happened in terms of the response. There were thousands of Iranian protesters that were killed, mowed down by the IRGC. This is 3 months ago. This is not going back to Tiananmen Square, even though it's a startling example as well. This just happened this year. And yet, you know, you don't really hear about that. You could see some of these tweets on America's mainstream media saying, look at what the rest of the world thinks of us.
Yeah,
the same language exists. And then just one more, and this was the Ayatollah again gloating over what was happening. He said, "Imam Khomeini, this is the previous supreme leader, caused the U.S. leaders at the time to admit that he had humiliated them. He proved that superpowers can be broken and beaten. You saw how the USSR collapsed, and you can see the status of the US today. So he's calling right there for the complete destruction of the American superpower and saying it's happening right now. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I mean, Turkey was the same. The Erdogan, a NATO ally, got out and he expressed his desire to stand with the protesters as well. And so you really must stop to think when what you are hearing in the mainstream media in the United States is the same as what is coming out of Iran, Russia, China, Turkey, then perhaps what your own media is saying isn't correct, but is part of this propaganda machine as well.
Mm-hmm. Over to Europe now, especially Germany, to Richard.
Yeah, well, starting just here in the UK, we've had similar protests to the ones in the US, though for less violent, less rioting and looting, though police have been just completely attacked out of the blue. And it is a pretty surreal set of protests. You know, they've not just been protesting outside the American embassy, but outside number 10 Downing Street. Black Lives Matter has had a protest, I think, just either earlier today or yesterday outside Dominic Cummings' house, who is an advisor to the Prime Minister, you know, mostly on Brexit. I'm not sure what on earth he has to do with the behavior of American police, but that's the kind of a protest. There is, I think, there's a strong movement from the radical left within the UK to try and say, well, Britain has exactly the same policing problems, race problems as America does. But the attempt is just weird, given how different even the approach to policing is. You know, you had protesters shouting "hands up, don't shoot" at British police who aren't armed and who couldn't shoot them even if they wanted to because they didn't have any guns. I mean, it makes no sense. So there's that push within the UK to try and import the same kind of social unrest that we have in the US. And then meanwhile, in Europe and in especially Germany, you've seen the same push that you have seen and would expect, say, from America's enemies, from places like China and Iran. But you've seen that coming now from Germany. And you've had German newspapers especially acting just like the mainstream media in the U.S., painting this really distorted picture of a racist United States. So Spiegel Online had an article. There was great outrage in Germany about the violent death of George Floyd, and it talked about a global pandemic called racism. And then FAS, a German news site, they had an article, "The United States, a Failed Social Experiment." And they said that this article was painting the hopeless picture from a country in freefall. It talked then Tagspiel, they had an article saying, well, Donald Trump reaps what he fertilized well. The racism that brought him into office should secure his reelection. He has nothing else. Other articles said something like, it's true, racism in the United States didn't just start since George Floyd was brutally killed. Then it goes on to say, it is open and hidden, systematic and systemic. If you want to see it, you can see it. If you don't want to see it, you won't see it. And on and on and on it goes. And we have an article from Joshua called "Germany Outraged at Racist America" on the Trumpet website, just making the point that, well, if you're going to look for racism in a country that has had the record levels of anti-Semitic crimes, that is having problems with its elite military being infiltrated with the far right, and having its own right-wing extremists shooting up synagogues, like happened in October 2019. And then you have accusations of police looking the other way, of intelligence services helping racist extremist groups and even potentially being involved in murders of Turks and Muslims. You know, there's a lot of big problems within Germany that if you wanted to root out racism, you could start. But instead, you see this real full court press across a lot of Europe to paint that distorted picture of America as a racist society and one that liberal, tolerant, multicultural Europe, the good guys of the world, must oppose.
Yeah. You know, just watching all of this, Stephen Fleury has been drawing attention just how far in advance the Trumpet magazine has been so often. And I think about the most recent issue that we published with the cover story by Brad McDonald that's called The Global Ambition to Destroy America and Its President. And that was before any of this erupted regarding George Floyd. But he's showing how, especially with the response to COVID-19, that there is just ample evidence of how universal this desire to bring America down is. And you see all of that ramped up three or four notches in recent days with the global response to what happened in Minneapolis. I would really encourage you to go and read that article by Brad McDonald, and he's drawing attention and just amplifying some of what our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has been saying about just how much Satan is behind this effort to bring the number one superpower in the world down. We will link to that article in the show notes, as well as several of the other articles that we've been discussing here. And looking at what is happening is very concerning, but this is where the view that biblical prophecy provides is so useful, so hopeful. A lot of people are looking at these events with concern and fear and hopelessness, but when you understand how it's fulfilling prophecy and the fact that God foresaw it and foretold where it is ultimately leading, you see the bigger picture. You see how much hope there is in these events. If I can, I'd like to put in a plug for our free email service, Signposts. Many of you are aware of our Trumpet Brief, but Signposts is another email service that we produce. It comes out Tuesdays and Fridays, and it's more focused on the Bible, and it points to our sister website, pcg.church. The email that's going out today has an article accompanying Gerald Fleury's Key of David program about Satan's frightening power. And the second item on today's email is another article, Keep Hope Alive. It says, bad news is descending like a tidal wave. Hold your head high. And talking specifically about how these terrible events point to the greatest news story ever to occur, the second coming of Jesus Christ, as we watch these devastating times unfold around us and we watch our world as we should. This is hope we need to hold on to. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. You are listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we'll look at other news that has taken place this past week, including an escalation of the battle for control over the European Union, Vladimir Putin liberalizing his nation's potential to use nuclear weapons, and America's determination to completely vacate Afghanistan. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We spoke in a recent program about Germany's Constitutional Court undermining the European Central Bank and essentially establishing itself as the highest authority in Europe. Well, this week, the ECB lashed back, and the battle over control over the EU's finances escalated. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes. So the European Central Bank, they basically doubled down on their position, saying that they can essentially print money and do what they like with it and that they don't need to pay attention to what the court says. They said that they're going to basically print another 600 billion euros and buy up government debt with that. And that would especially be Italian debt, keeping it afloat. Now, when the German Constitutional Court ruled, they were ruling on what the European Central Bank was doing 5 years ago or so, or more than that, after the 2008 financial crisis. It wasn't specifically about the coronavirus, but they're basically doing exactly the same thing. They're doing exactly the same thing that the court complained about. So, you know, we weren't sure whether this was going to blow up into a full-scale confrontation at the time. Now it does look like the European Central Bank is not backing down. Sebastian Conchard, a former French Treasury official, he said that the European Central Bank's decision was a declaration of war against the German Constitutional Court, Holger Schmeiding from Baron Bank. He said that the ECB has shown that it remains a truly independent institution, fully committed to its mandate of price stability, and is not in any way constrained by the verdict of the Constitutional Court. And we were talking about the euro crisis and the different ways that this could play out and coronavirus on Wednesday's show. But I think one of the things where this ties in with that as well is, you know, in 2008, you saw Germany step up and flex its muscles in a way that it has preferred to hide in times past. And I do wonder now, maybe with the European Central Bank openly defying Germany, will we see that again? Will you see now Germany really making clear they're the ones in charge of the Eurozone and having to smack them down in a more public way when they would have preferred to keep that strength hidden for now? And at some point, I think Germany's going to start to be more comfortable operating with its power out in the open. And maybe with this corona crisis, we'll start to see that happening more. We've been watching German power in Europe for a long, long time. And that is one of the key things that we've been zooming in on with these crises. You can go back all the way back to just the days after World War II ended, and Herbert W. Armstrong was saying, Germany is going to rise again. And more than that, Germany is going to lead an economic union of nations that's going to become a political union. Germany is going to be the most dominant member of that union. They're going to be the ones essentially calling the shots. And when Mr. Armstrong was saying that in the aftermath of World War II, he even used the term European Union, exactly the same name that it's got today. He was saying, you know, that's where this is leading. And I don't think there were many people at all in May 1945 who were looking at this rubble-strewn country that was Germany and saying, well, they're going to rise up again and be the dominant power in Europe. But he kept making that forecast for decade after decade. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry was making that same forecast, even from the earliest issues of the Philadelphia Trumpet. You know, watch for Germany to rise as the head of Europe. And we've seen that already. We've seen that play out a lot already. We saw that happen in the 2008 financial crisis, their power put on display. And the reason why Mr. Armstrong was able to make that forecast all the way back in May is the Bible talks very specifically about Europe and Germany playing a key role in this end time. And there's a lot of specifics that the Bible tells us about this power. If you put the different prophecies in the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation together, Revelation 18 talks about it being an economic power that dominates global trade. And Revelation 17 talks about it being made up of 10 nations united under one strong man and having a religious element. And so that Mr. Armstrong made all of these forecasts, and he made them at a time that humanly it would be crazy to make those forecasts. And you can see that playing out now. We're in the midst of that playing out with this particular struggle and who's got more power, the German Constitutional Court or the European Central Bank, and how exactly is this going to move forwards. But we know where this ends already.
Right.
And so what you can do is you see this unfold, and as you see the updates coming out every few weeks, is you can see more and more proof. Well, you know, there is a God that inspired this to be forecast in 1945 based on prophecies that were written down in AD 45, well, not AD 45, but you get the picture, 2000 years ago. And even then with the book of Daniel, hundreds of years before that. So the idea of Bible prophecy informing world news could seem unusual or extreme to a lot of people. But this example in particular is just one where you see it being proven dramatically accurate and will continue to do so in the months ahead.
Right. Well, we definitely will keep our eye on what is happening there. And you could see even more dramatic fulfillment of this Germany actually flexing its muscle and taking over control of Europe financially. So thank you very much for that, Richard. We will put a link to Richard's article that was put up on the Trumpet site this week, Coronavirus Leaves Germany More Dominant Than Ever. And we appreciate that. Since the Cold War, people have tended to stop thinking about nuclear war, but nuclear non-proliferation efforts have been taking serious steps backward lately. This week, an announcement from Russia's strongman leader seemed to escalate the possibility of nuclear war. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, Russian President Vladimir Putin approved a new policy on Tuesday that will allow Russia to use nuclear weapons considerably more easily. So the policy before this one had never been publicly published, and we know that it was not a strict no-first-use policy, but it was understood to make it very, very difficult for a Russian leader to legally make any kind of nuclear strike on another power unless Russia or one of its allies had been hit by nuclear weapons first. But this new policy lays out actually a couple of different circumstances in which Russia can use nuclear weapons without it having to have been struck by them first. So one part of it says, if conventional forces pose an existential threat to Russia, then it can respond with nuclear weapons. Another section says Russia can mount a nuclear response if it receives information saying its adversaries are launching a ballistic missile attack on Russia or one of its allies. So it's all just really loosening the restrictions, I think, apparently quite a bit. And when you consider just how high the stakes are with nuclear weapons, I think this is just a chilling change that we need to keep a close eye on.
So Russia says that it's not going to start a nuclear attack. They've made that assurance even recently, as they've been upgrading their nuclear arsenal, but there is cause to not want to take Russia completely at its word here.
For sure, yes. Yeah, Russia even now is still saying, despite these changes, they would not initiate a nuclear attack. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov reiterated that this week after the news broke about this policy change. But the trouble with that is that history shows that the word of the Russians about no first-use policy is not reliable. During the Cold War, the Soviet leadership made a pledge, actually a formal pledge, in 1982 never to use nuclear weapons first in a conflict under any circumstances. But after the Soviet Union collapsed, a trove of Soviet military records was obtained by some NATO nations showing that they actually did have plans in place to use nuclear weapons first. There's a document that was published by the French Foreign Office in 1999. It says, military records of the Warsaw Pact that fell into German hands demonstrated beyond doubt that Russian operational plans called for the use of nuclear and chemical weapons in Germany at the onset of hostilities, even if NATO forces were using only conventional weapons. So, you know, during the Soviet days, you have the Russians formally pledging that they would not use nuclear weapons first, but then secretly they had plans to use them first. Today you have Russia actually publicly loosening the rules for themselves to be able to use them first. And what you have to really think about here is how other nations will view this kind of thing.
Sure.
How trigger-happy it might make some of the other nuclear powers to understand what Russia's doing there.
And Bible prophecy does say this is something we need to be concerned about.
For sure, yes. There's a place in the book of Matthew that we often go to that, you know, it shows that the Bible prophesies of a war that will break out, that will threaten to end all human life. And logistically, we know that that would have to mean nuclear war. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has written all about this in his booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. He talks in there quite a lot about Russia's nuclear weapons and also those of China and North Korea and other nations. And he puts it all in the context of Bible prophecy to show that these weapons will very soon be used. There is a war coming that's on a scale that's hard for us to even imagine. But Mr. Fleury also really emphasizes the good news that's connected to that terrifying truth. And he stresses how God will intervene in that war before mankind is able to totally annihilate himself. One short part from that booklet says, "The good news is God will shorten the time span and save us alive. But if he did not intervene, there wouldn't be anyone alive on this planet. He will let it go a long way so that people learn that they can't rule themselves. Men don't know the way of peace, but God knows. And if you keep his law of love, it will bring great joy and peace into your life."
All right. Well, thank you for that. We will link to that booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, on the show notes for today's program. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. As we've discussed in recent programs, Libya is turning out to be a major battlefield, a proxy war between outside countries from the U.S., Europe, Middle East, Asia. This week, two outside nations were caught smuggling weapons into Libya. For this story, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this refers to Russia smuggling weapons and also Iran smuggling weapons into Libya. This involved Syrian jets or planes from a Syrian carrier flying into Libya and sending drones and anti-tank missiles on those jets. And interestingly enough, they were given to the LNA. This is the Libya National Army operating outside of mainly in eastern Libya. Ever since Gaddafi fell, you basically have two sides in Libya internally. You have the LNA that's led by General Khalifa Haftar. That's on the right side or the eastern side of the country. And then around Tripoli, you have the GNA, which is the UN-backed government that has support from most European states. And they have been at war with each other and often getting supplies, ammunition, support from different outside powers. And as you mentioned, this is becoming a heated proxy war with all these different powers. Now, up to this point, we haven't really seen a strong Iranian presence on the ground at all. But that is something that we watch for with a keen eye based on biblical prophecy. We talk about Daniel 11 and verse 40, which talks about the king of the south pushing at the king of the north. It's the basis for the starting, really, of World War III. And the king of the south, as we've talked about, is radical Islam led by Iran and an alliance that is with Iran against a European force, the King of the North. And our editor-in-chief has written that these two powers are going to clash inside Libya. Libya is going to be a staging point between a battle between the radical Islamists by Iran and the King of the North by a European power that comes in there. So up until this point, Iran hasn't been there much at all. And yet what we see now is Iran finally entering into this proxy war. And that should be something that we need to watch. And we're going to watch it for you at thetrumpet.com and write about it as time goes forward. It's really interesting that Iran is sending weapons and arms to the side you wouldn't expect them to send weapons and arms to, because if you look at where most of the Islamists are, they are fighting on behalf of the GNA right now, which operates out of the western side of the country. That's where the Islamists are. And the eastern side, led by Khalifa Haftar, is on board with Egypt, is on board with the Emiratis, is on board with these nations that are fighting Iran and other places. And yet, over the past 3 weeks, there's been severe fallback by Haftar's army. This eastern army is losing power and losing power fast. So it might be that they are just accepting the willing help of Iran, and Iran then supplying the arms, hoping to get a foot in the door for a continued presence. Now, I think this is extremely interesting because biblical prophecy has Iran allying with Egypt, has Iran allying with Ethiopia, perhaps Sudan there in between Ethiopia and Egypt, and then with Libya. And so you'd expect that the eastern part of Libya would fall closer to Iran's side than the western part of Libya. And here you have Iran supporting that eastern Libyan government, even though they're not Islamist at this point. So this is something we're going to keep track of for you at thetrumpet.com.
And you're speaking just geographically, the eastern part of Libya.
Yes, exactly.
Well, we will link to Gerald Fleury's article, Libya and Ethiopia Reveal Iran's Military Strategy. He's written quite a bit about this alliance prophesied between Iran and Libya. And so definitely check that out. And we appreciate you keeping your eyes on that for us, Brent. And before I let you go, President Donald Trump tweeted this week that the U.S. is going to completely pull its troops out of Afghanistan. Maybe you can tell us about that a little bit.
Yes, this was his tweet from May 27th. He said, "We are acting as a police force, not the fighting force that we are in Afghanistan. After 19 years, it's time for them to police their own country, bring our soldiers back home, but closely watch what is going on and strike with a thunder like never before if necessary." And so he's just showing that this is one of his goals. Of course, we know this is one of his goals. He did sign a deal with the Taliban back in February that gave 14 months for the troop withdrawal. of the 14,000 troops that were there that would then take it all the way through to April 2021 is when the last 8,000 that are there right now would come home. And yet it's very easy to see how he will want to bring those troops home before the election. He was given a number of options by United States generals as to what some of the plans could be to bring the troops home. And one of those was organizing a withdrawal before the November election. And if he's thinking smart, like he often does, in this way, he could see that the Taliban aren't going to change what they're doing between now and next year in 2021 when they're due to come out anyway. So he might gamble that it's worth it for the election victory to bring the troops home. This is something that he specifically campaigned on that he has not delivered in really any arena, not Syria, not Iraq, not Afghanistan. Nowhere have the troops come home in terms of en masse out of these foreign theaters. And so maybe he'll try and push for that before the election.
Well, we have an article by Warren Reinsch up about this, all U.S. troops to leave Afghanistan. You can check that out at thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much, Brent, and all of you gentlemen. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. We really do appreciate the work of our panel today, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production as well. I'll leave you with the words of Henry Ford. Most people spend more time and energy going around problems than in trying to solve them. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.